Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James's
Pete. G'day, everyone.
It is the 26th of October, and this is episode 83. Knew that from the start. And we've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Marijke Tuthill-Bekkun from the Foundation for Individual Rights in
Marijke.
Education.
Marijke. Like paprika.
Yep. What did I say? Anyway, we'll continue.
Something else.
Did I? Damn it. But I nailed it in the interview, and that's what matters. So we're going to be talking to her from Fire Network in the US. They're an amazing organization that do a lot of work on restoring free speech to American college campuses, making sure the campus censorship doesn't continue on its path. Really cool chat, getting into the weeds on all the free speech issues that are happening in American colleges, which I know a lot of our listeners care about.
Live from Philly. Or recorded from Philly.
Yes, absolutely. And we are also going to be talking to IPA Development Associate Jin Campbell. Keep on getting thrown off by that. All right, to people out there, do not have different surnames on Facebook than you do in real life. It throws me off. I thought my friend Bobby had the different surname for like a year, and boy was my face red when I figured that out.
Sounds like a good friend.
He is a good guy. But where are we at? So we're going to be talking to Jin about some of the IPA's events that are coming up soon. They are going to be a lot of fun. And really cool chat. She's also got a new puppy. So yep. A bit of puppy chat.
Very excited.
Pete had some opinions about puppies.
Some pretty controversial views on dogs.
Yes.
Tune in.
All right. So let's talk about it. So I think the big story this week, Pete, was the Change of the Rules protest.
That's right. The Change of the Rules protest organised by the ACTU here in Australia. Up to 150,000 people and lots of people around the country marched this week for the ACTU's Change the Rules campaign, which argues that Australia needs a pay rise. Tell me about it, ACTU. Here's a quote from the ACTU media release. The costs of childcare, petrol, power, transport and housing, which form a large part of working families' budget, are growing up to 8 times faster than wages. Working people and lower incomes are disproportionately affected by increases in these unavoidable costs. You don't say, ACTU. So increase the burden on employees through more unionised workplaces that are creating this inflation in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people marching. So here's my problem with the protest.
Tell me about your protest.
It's a very specific problem with the protest.
Yeah, okay.
Was that I was running a little late for work that day.
Yeah, right.
If I made this train, I would have been okay.
And you're late. So
I've never been late for
already
anything.
An
in
amazing
my life.
Story.
I've never been late. Nina, never been late.
Of course.
But I needed to top up my Mikey. So I'm like, look, if I run the last 500 meters, I should be okay.
Okay, probably bad.
If you're as late as if you're as late as me to things, you start to pace out how much you can run for. And then I get there and it's going to be okay. And then there are like 10 or 15 people heading to the union march, just topping up Mikey's, and they took forever because none of them knew how to buy a ticket. And there was just one person ushering them through. So it's a lot of a lot of faces of pure bewilderment at the idea of a ticket machine. That was my problem with the protest. I was very late for work.
What an interesting life James leads.
Thank you. I just needed that off my chest. I needed an outlet.
Well,
it's annoying.
That's what the podcast is for, James.
Yeah, it's just to talk my gripes.
About random stuff that annoys you in your life. No. Daniel White has an interesting graph about this, which I'm sure a lot of listeners have
about
seen.
About my train journey?
he's working on that, where it's got all the items that an Australian family might buy, and of course those that have far more government intervention, like childcare, education, etc. Cost the inflation rate has gone up a lot more than items that don't have government intervention.
Yes, and I'll make a serious point. So the IPA put out a media release on the day of the protest, talking about some of the stuff that they should be protesting for. So IPA research fellow Kurt Wallace, newly minted friend of the program, he was on last week. Fresh off the conveyor belt and into the media release firestorm. So this is his first one. So he says, Australia has one of the world's most inflexible, complex and extensive industrial relations regimes, which Pete was just talking about. The ACTU's demands to slap more rules on Australia's IR regime would make it even harder for Australians to get a job and experience the dignity of work. It would hurt the 650,000 Australians who are looking for work, the 1.1 million who are looking for more work, and countless others who have simply given up on looking and left the workplace altogether. Gideon Rosner, also a friend of the show, chimed in as well. He said, Sally McManus and the unions like to talk about the working poor, but there is no greater fast track to poverty than being out of work. The union movement is stuck in the past in a mindset of class warfare that Australians moved on decades ago.
They must know that you can't just increase. Like, they must know what they propose makes everything more expensive.
Yeah, but...
Is that, hey, am I missing something?
No, you just need to tax the rich more.
That's right.
Yeah, you're just missing that variable. Okay. Just tax the rich more.
And can I make one more point about protests?
If you have to.
Up to 160,000 people. When the news report says organisers claim up to 160,000 people, it's a lot less than that.
Yeah. I remember like my first experience with protest numbers was like, I can't remember what the protest was for, but it ended with all of them sitting in the MCG. My dad immediately, the second he heard that, went, never do that. Because that gives the people a huge indicator that this is like a, you know, St Kilda North game, MCG crowd.
Yep.
Always keep on the move is my advice on protest. Never stand still. Never let a headcount happen. Yep. Keep switching around.
For those out there planning mass disobedience.
Yeah. Cool. So I think we'll talk another big march, Pete.
Yeah, let's do more protests.
Yeah, more protests. So the People's Vote March happened in the UK on Saturday. This is 500,000 anti-Brexit campaigners. They all went...
Sorry? Organisers.
Another organisers one. They kept on the move. That's what you got to do. So 500,000 anti-Brexit campaigners, allegedly, they went down to London to protest the vote of 17.5 million people. And
probably
don't
already
want it...
from London.
Yeah. Oh, probably. There's not a whole lot of people coming from the country. But I don't want to confuse too many of our listeners because there's been a lot of maths early on. But 17.5 million is more than 500,000.
Whoa. Slow down. Hang on. You gotta call it.
70.5 is bigger than 500,000. In a show of hands, the pro-Brexit vote still wins.
Yeah.
But this didn't stop a lot of the usual suspects from saying, like, we definitely need a second vote, which is something we've been talking about on the show. I think with Brendan O'Neill, we last discussed whether or not there's going to be another referendum. Basically, the idea, like, it's been 2 years since Brexit. All the lies have suddenly been revealed, and now we need another vote.
It's actually pretty bizarre.
It's very bizarre. And this is the other thing of, like, the Theresa May government has been dragging so slowly towards Brexit that it gives them this voice. Like, this is a shambles, we need another vote because you guys have stuffed it up. My favourite one comes from Sadiq Khan, who is the London mayor. Yeah. We've talked about it on the show before. He says, we've heard some complain that the public vote would be undemocratic and unpatriotic. The opposite is true. There is nothing more democratic, nothing more British than trusting the people to have the final say on our future. Which has already happened.
Yeah. Actually, I've got...
If I can refer Mr. Khan back to the Brexit vote, which happened... And they lost.
That is the exact same quote that I put down, James, on my notes. And it sort of sums it up for me. It's like, hang on.
Yeah.
What?
No, sorry.
Are you dinking, mate?
Yeah, no. They need to have another vote where they decide the right answer and then we're done.
Yeah.
Like, what I would really love, like, I actually kind of want a second vote at this point. Because Brexit would win by such a majority that, I mean, we saw some pretty good... facial expressions when Brexit won the first time.
Oh.
The second time?
Do it again.
Wow.
And put on the thing, hard Brexit, soft Brexit, or no Brexit. Because then there's no... What's the word? Indecision.
Yeah, there's no lying.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm getting old, James, but I don't understand. Yeah, I feel like I'm missing something.
Yeah. I just want to know what the lies were. People just say, oh, they were lying the whole time. Now the lies have come out. There hasn't been a Brexit. What are the lies?
Yeah.
The lies are we didn't really want to do it. Like, I think we knew that at the time.
Yeah. Anyway. Yep. Nah, crazy stuff. Organisers claim. what are we up to? Obama. Okay. So.
Is that a meme? Sorry, I'm just. Yeah, I've got Pete's a. Notes. I've Pete's got a meme. Verbal meme.
I've got a meme in my notes. It's actually pronounced meme, mate. So, no, President Barack Obama. Talking about, because Trump's got good economic figures at the moment, President Barack Obama has said in a speech during the week, when you hear all this talk about economic miracles right now, remember who started it. Mm. Of course, Obama talking about himself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Obama has a bit of a track record of claiming credit for economic success of other people. You'll remember in 2012, James, Nina, when Obama said, somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we have that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, bit of a track record, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we talked about this in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday, saying how if I'm President Obama, I really wouldn't want people dusting off the economic history books and seeing how I did, because... Mm-hmm. We had the graph showing what they thought when they did the GFC stimulus package, and they were like, you know what, this is, you know, it's going to stink for a little while with unemployment, but it's going to get a whole much better. And then, it's actually much worse.
Yeah, no, that was good to dust off that old graph.
Yeah. So the stat, just to give it some sort of importance
give us a stat.
So in September 2012, the White House predicted, when they were getting together in early 2009, putting together the stimulus package, they predicted that in September 2012, there would be a 5.6% unemployment rate. It actually turned out being 7.8, which is, a bit of a...
It's more.
Yeah, it's more.
It's higher.
Yeah, again, a lot of maths.
Yeah.
A lot of maths.
And this sorry to interrupt there, James, but also this is from the Economic Genius, who said there are some structural issues with our economy. This is when he's president, where a lot of businesses have learned to become much more efficient with a lot fewer workers. You can see when you go to a bank and use an ATM, you don't have to go to a bank teller. Or you go to the airport and you're using a kiosk instead of checking in to the gate.
Anti-ATM.
Mm. Big critic of the ATM.
How did he get away? Like, if McCain said that, there would have been so many memes.
Yeah.
Well, of just old man yelling at... we have a meme here.
Well, this is a slightly different meme.
Hello.
But it's probably true because it's on the internet. Obama says America will never see 3% economic growth again. Trump doesn't have a magic wand. And then also I take credit for Trump's 4% economic growth.
Oh, bit of a...
Good point.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Wait, it should have been a distracted boyfriend meme, which would have been banned from Sweden. But, old girl saying that there's no 3% growth. Obama looking at the new girl... 4% growth.
Well,
taking credit for it.
There's lots of options, yeah, James.
A lot of memes. Cool. So I'll move on to another one. This one developing at the moment. New energy policy. Always sends chills down everyone's spine when the government says they got a new energy policy. This one, it's been called Big Stick Energy Policy. They've really got it. Sorry?
Is that you thought of that?
Call it Big Stick.
Yep.
No. So they've got a big stick, the Big Stick Energy Policy.
Okay.
They've got a lot of Big Stick Energy Policy.
Yeah, right.
And so basically the idea is, so Scott Morrison and Energy Minister Angus Taylor have said they'll forecast the use of forced divestment from companies, from power companies, if required, if they, don't play by the rules or don't do stuff out of regulations. Forced divestment.
Mm-hmm.
Seems a little weird.
It's about time the government got involved in the energy market, James.
Yeah, exactly.
Fix all the problems.
There's a lot of problems. Prices are too high, and if you don't bring it down, we're going to divest the company.
Yep.
There'll be absolutely no problems. None at all. Foresee a problem that comes with the government getting forced divestment powers over energy companies.
I think we've solved it.
I think we have solved it. All right, cool. Let's move on to some of the... you've got one more thing. This is hot off the presses. So much so that I'm still looking around my notes. Sorry. RBA today has released a new parliamentary research brief. By the time the podcast goes out, it'll be available on our website. Daniel Wilde about the Paris Climate Agreement, one of his favourite topics. He is not a fan of that agreement. So the parliamentary research brief is 10 points about the Paris Climate Agreement, talking about the impacts that it's going to have on Australia's economy, how Australia isn't living up to our agreements and nor is anyone else in the world. So why are we doing this? It's such a risk to our economy. So if you do care about Paris Climate Agreement and all the stuff that comes with that, that is available on our website. Now, I think if you just want the Paris Climate Accord to happen, just need a big stick.
Yeah.
Just have a big stick energy policy, but globally.
A big enough stick.
Yeah. Just, threaten military action against countries that don't play by the Paris Climate Accord.
That's a stick and a half.
It's a big stick. Got to have big stick energy policy.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So we'll move on to a few other things. So the IPA this week, pretty big week. So this morning, we've released a new episode of the Great Books of Literature podcast. So I know a lot of people are getting around that. Number one in the arts category on iTunes. People are absolutely loving it. This week's episode, or this fortnight's episode, episode 6 on Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. So if you do like the book, maybe you like Apocalypse Now. The film, amazing film.
Mm, and as I said previously, not to be mixed up with the nightclub in Phnom Penh, also called Heart of Darkness.
Yes. No book about that has ever been written. Or will there?
Which is a shame.
Yeah. Because Fate's got a story. Cool. So, Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. Make sure you listen to that. John Roskam, Andrew Bolt, they're going to be talking about the book, a few of the issues that come out. I mean, it's a lot of, in the age of like post-colonialism and there's a lot of reflections on the book and what it says about colonialism. So, they talk about that and they talk about Western civilization, like how can you approach your Western civilization when you read Heart of Darkness and you know what was going on in Africa as a result of colonialism? Can you still support Western civilization? So really interesting chat. You've also got Andrew Bushnell. He was in the IPA review, A Conservative Answer to Liberalism's Crisis. That's a really cool book review. That's available on our website now.
It's a review of three books.
It is.
Three for the price of one.
Three for the price of one. So, and then over on our YouTube channel and our Facebook page. So, the IPA has released the first episode of a new series we're doing called IPA Explainer. And this is going to be Gideon Rosner talking you through why the ABC should be privatized, the points for it, and what we're talking about when we talk about ABC privatization. So go to our Facebook page and YouTube channel. You can also see Matthew Lesh talk about the need for free speech on campus, which is a topic we're going to be talking about in just a few seconds. So we also have a few events that we need to run through. So we're going to be talking about this with Jin later in the show. We've got Dan Hannan coming to Perth on the 30th of October and Melbourne on the 31st of October. All the links are available through the IPA's Hey, What Did I Miss email. So if you are getting that email, just go back through. And if you don't get the email, go to ipa.org.au and subscribe. You'll have all the details there. Hannan, 30th of October in Perth, 31st of October in Melbourne.
With our friends at the Menzies Research Centre.
Very good save by you there, Pete. And we also have the 75th anniversary dinner on the 29th of November. So that is going to be a really great night. IPA 75 years. So we're celebrating that. There's going to be a lot of great guest speakers. Janet Olbrechtson, Andrew Bolt, and Brendan O'Neill.
After party at Warney's Nightclub, 23. That's on the official invite. So yeah, is it actually? Leave that in.
Is it actually?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, wow.
Maybe not. Let's check.
With Shane Warne.
Yeah.
As long as we're just shooting from the hip here,
yeah.
Shane Warne will make a guest appearance.
Yeah.
Cool. So that is it for the show at the start. So thank you guys so much for listening and subscribing. You know we're available. We just need you to keep telling your friends and family about the show. We've had a lot of new listeners coming in over the last few weeks, and make sure that keeps on going up. And if you are listening on iTunes, you have the option to leave this show a review. Please do so. Please leave us that 5-star review and maybe a comment, maybe a tip for the show, maybe something you want to hear more of, or maybe your own Q&A clap moment. Who knows what it is? Just put it in the comments. And Nina, if people want to become a member of the IPA, they hear what we talk about and they want to support it, where can people go if they want to become a member?
Just visit the website at ipa.org.au and click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per month, per year.
$22 a month is hefty.
But yeah, you become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
All right, cool. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we now welcome to the show Marijke Beck-Koon, Director of Litigation at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE. They're an amazing organization out of the US doing a lot of work against campus censorship and making sure that free speech happens on university campuses. So Marijke, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brilliant. So you're going to be Skyping into Australia at a conference where IPA research fellow Matthew Lesh is also going to be speaking next month. And this whole conference, it's run by APN Educational Media. It's the fight for free speech, what it means for universities. It's going to be a really great conference. We're looking forward to it. So what are some of the things you're going to be talking about? Obviously, we don't want to give away your speech, but what are some of the areas you're going to be talking
Spoiler
about?
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. If you've got tickets, tune out.
Well, I won't give away anything too much, but I'm going to be giving kind of the international perspective on the issue of speech codes and talking about how they developed historically in the U.S., how they've traditionally been used, and how they're treated under the law in the U.S., and kind of make a comparison to how they've been, how they're treated in courts in our country versus in Australia, and kind of trying to draw some parallels.
Cool. So you work for an organisation called the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education with the acronym of FIRE. That's a very cool acronym. Was that deliberate or was it just luck?
I got to imagine it was deliberate. I don't know. I actually have to go ask our founders about that.
If you could, that would be great.
It was deliberate or not. I'm sure they did what they could to work it into the acronym.
Yeah, absolutely. If it was the Organization for Individual Rights in Education, OIA doesn't really have that same kick as FIRE. But anyway, so you guys talk about defending and sustaining individual rights to students and faculty members at America's colleges and universities. So tell me briefly, what exactly does a FIRE network do? Is it more a legal firm or an activist kind of thing?
Well, we're kind of a combination. So we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. Our specific substantive areas are freedom of speech, due process, academic freedom, freedom of conscience on American campuses. So we like to say we have a narrow but deep mission area, and kind of within that mission area, we engage in a really wide range of advocacy and public education. Some of our bigger projects and departments are our policy reform department, which they do a review of speech codes, which, just for listeners, are college policies that restrict student or faculty speech. They do these a review at over 400 of our top U.S. colleges and universities. And bear in mind, in our country, we have thousands of colleges and universities. And they put out an annual report, I guess just as IPA does, on the state of speech codes nationwide. We've been doing that for over 10 years, and they often work directly with universities to reform problematic speech codes. So another major push and campaign that we have is a campaign to adopt, getting universities to adopt the Chicago Statement, which is a 2015 policy statement that came out of the Committee on Freedom of Expression at the University of Chicago. And it's really an institutional commitment to give all university community members the widest possible latitude for speaking and writing and learning and discourse. And I think we're at 49 institutions at this point that have signed on to that. But I'd say the last major area in the area that I'm involved with at FIRE is that we defend the rights of individual students and faculty members. So that looks different depending on the case. Sometimes that involves a combination of private and public advocacy or public advocacy. Often we will write letters to the institution raising our concerns surrounding academic or free speech. We'll issue press releases. We'll share a person's story with the media in order to try and generate attention. Or in some cases, we will bring an individual's case to court.
Yeah, really cool. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier in that answer, the Chicago Statement, because this is something we've mm-hmm. talked about on the show briefly before. We had one of Australia's senators come in and he was talking about how he'd like to see the Chicago thing adopted in Australia. Do you want to expand on what that is and what the implications are for free speech?
Sure, it is. So in 2015, the University of Chicago convened a committee of its own faculty and scholars to kind of study the question of what it means for an institution to, by its policy, articulate the greatest commitment to freedom of expression as an institution as a whole. And they came up with this statement that we kind of all call the Chicago Statement for short, that when it's adopted as a matter of institutional policy, it's the broadest expression and it's kind of a gold standard expression of how a university commits itself to allowing the greatest and broadest discourse, open discourse on campus to all of its community members, and kind of makes that commitment publicly. And that having it in place as an overall policy statement is the standard by which you then form the university that commits to form its subsidiary policies. So the idea being, if you have a school that has adopted the Chicago Statement, that you're not going to then have overly restrictive speech codes in existence or being put into place at that university because they've made the commitment to make their policies consistent with the broadest possible latitude to speak.
What kind of popularity does the Chicago Statement have in the United States? Is it something that a lot of universities have or a small percentage? And are you aware of universities in other places in the world that have adopted it?
Well, in the U.S., it's I'm not familiar outside of the U.S. with how it's taken to what extent it's gained in popularity. But within the U.S., I would say it's been gaining greater and greater exposure since 2015 when it came out. Like I said, we've had 49 institutions that we know of in the U.S. that have explicitly adopted it either through either as an administration or through their faculty senates. And I expect to see that number continue to grow in coming years and probably start to grow at a kind of snowball rate, I would expect, because as you know, I'm sure you're aware, is the case in Australia, we've had quite a bit of attention being paid to the issue of free speech on campus in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get into some of the lessons for Australia a bit later. I just want to talk because Pete and I keep an eye on the news, and there seems to be a new free speech at university or college issue coming out of the US every week. So what are some of the particular cases that you're looking at the moment and some of the universities that you're looking at closely?
Well, I will speak to the cases that I work on in my department. And those are specifically the cases that we take to court. And just to back up for a second, talk about what kind of, you know, what it looks like when we bring a case to court. We will sue, when a student or faculty an individual's free speech rights are violated, usually via an overbroad speech code, under a constitutional challenge, because the U.S. is fairly unique in that our First Amendment affirmatively grants a legally enforceable right to free speech vis-a-vis government actors. So in other words, an individual has the right to be free of rules, regulations, laws, or government actions that infringe on their speech. And public universities in the U.S. are government actors, so that if they have in place overbroad speech codes that are applied to students to restrict their speech, we are able to bring a constitutional challenge in court. So to speak to a couple of the cases that my department has ongoing, our most common cases are challenges to what we term free speech zones, and we also usually see along with those cases challenges to permitting policies. So free speech zones are policies that the schools will put in place to limit student demonstrations to small or kind of out of the way areas on campus, to kind of literally cabin speech to little parts of campus. And permit policies are policies that require students to either register their demonstration ahead of time, usually quite a bit ahead of time, or to often get approval for their speech or for their demonstration. So literally, like, I need to get your school's approval in order to go out and express my opinion or demonstrate or distribute literature or pamphlet. So those are kind of our most common cases. We have a few ongoing cases that challenge overbroad policies that prohibit harassment. So I know that's something that you guys see very often in Australia. So, for example, one ongoing case that we have is on behalf of a female professor who was fired from Louisiana State University under the terms of that school's sexual harassment policy, because she used, she termed it salty language, but she would use occasional profanity and sometimes use sexual language in her class while teaching, because it's just kind of part of her pedagogy. And she was fired under the school's sexual harassment policy, which the policy itself prohibits unwelcome verbal, visual, or physical behavior of a sexual nature. So we brought a First Amendment challenge to that, because under that policy, it's essentially impossible to define what kind of speech another person is going to take as unwelcome and of a sexual nature. So those are some examples of what we've got going at the moment.
Marika, thinking back over your time at FIRE, what would be your most, your favorite case, or maybe not favorite case, but the best case that you've done in your time? Most rewarding, best success, something like that.
I'd actually have to say that it's a case that we currently have ongoing. It's still open, so to speak. It's a lawsuit that we brought initially in 2017, filed it in 2017 in Los Angeles, against administrators at a community college and the Los Angeles Community College District, which is the biggest community college district in our whole country and has like over 100,000 students. and we, this case we brought for this truly just exceptional young man named Kevin Shaw. So he's on campus one day and he's trying to hand out pocket copies of our Constitution. And he was stopped by a college administrator who told him that, one, he needed to get a permit, and then he needed to take himself off to the free speech zone. And it's just, it's like, the scope of the import of this case, I think, is in its kind of scope and magnitude. This is a campus that had hundreds of acres, and the free speech zone that they're sending him to is basically the size of, like, a couple parking spaces shoved together. So, I mean, we have this awesome graphic on our web, somewhere on our website, that shows how if the whole campus was a tennis court, the free speech area would have been the size of an iPhone. So we brought this suit challenging the free speech zone policy at Kevin's college, and at the whole district level, because every college in the district was required to use free speech zones. So it's my favorite because the free speech zones here are so dramatically restrictive, and we stand to impact the free speech rights of so many students if we're successful, and truly because Kevin himself is just possibly he's politically active. Possibly the most civic-minded, principled, dedicated student I've ever gotten to work with. So that's my favorite.
Yeah, I really like the idea that a university administrator said there's no place for the U.S. Constitution on an American college.
Yeah.
And that's
that great. Really gets everybody mad.
Yeah, exactly. So that really brings out something, because like this is such a serious issue. There's so many huge implications, but there are stories that are just absolutely funny, like a university administrator saying that. Mm. Pete and I have a fondness for one particular case of what happened at Evergreen College to Brad Weinstein mm-hmm. is just terrible. But the footage of I think it was the dean, when he was asked, why did you let students accompany you to the bathroom to make sure you didn't escape? And he says, well, they were right to do that. I mean, there is something funny to this. Like, do you have like the most outrageous or most hilarious sort of free speech restriction at a college that comes to mind?
Well, I actually... I mean, we have so many outrageous ones, it's kind of hard to pick, but I'll pick one that we wrote a letter to the university about the other day. I'm forgetting off the top of my head which college it was. But it was a art censorship case, which is interesting because we've been seeing a number of those in recent years. And it was this school had taken down some public sculptures that had been garnering complaints because the public sculpture looked was kind of a representation of a giant vagina, and the school started getting all kinds of complaints about it. But it was an approved art project, you know, that meant a lot to the student who was displaying it, and the school, without warning, just took it down and threw it kind of behind the art center where it had been displayed.
That's a good one. So we'll talk about Australia for a second. So Australia now getting a lot of campus censorship problems of its own. We've had recent instance at the University of Sydney where there was actual violence to shut down a conservative speaker, Bettina Arndt's speech. And it's not going to go away. It's probably going to get worse, and we're probably going to end up like America. So what lessons do you reckon Australia can learn from the American experience with campus censorship as to how to make sure it doesn't get too bad?
Well, you know, I think the lesson I've learned as far as what's the most effective way to speak to students about this issue is this. I think students from any side of the, from all sides of the political spectrum, I tend to be very receptive and understanding of the kind of normative and not necessarily legal argument that you have to be really careful about what you're giving up in terms of when you're thinking about tools of censorship, and giving tools to government actors, like when you call for a school to ban a speaker, or you insist on having a speech code in place that bans hurtful language. I think students need to think about what they're giving up, because when you give a tool of censorship to the government, it's hard to get it back, and you can never guarantee that it's not going to be used against you. University administrators are inherently conservative, and I don't mean that politically. I mean they're conservative in the sense that they're generally concerned with keeping things calm and preventing disruption and preventing controversy. So if you're giving them the tools to define the permissible scope of discourse on campus, then, you know, don't be surprised when that's used against you, no matter who you are on the who you are and where you are in the political spectrum. But because, you know, you can turn vague language or decisions that are made based off of offense or the desire to close down controversial speech. Policies that are based on that are going to turn into anybody's weapon, because inevitably somebody else is going to figure out how to use them, right? Like you see, something we see and hear a lot is that students who are either liberal or conservative, they just weaponize notions of hurt or offense or whatever the words are that are going to get the administration to do your bidding. They just weaponize it against each other. And that's easy to do because, of course, no matter what you say, it could potentially be offensive to somebody and it could be hurtful to somebody. So I continually exhort students to think through the consequences of where they're giving up their own power and potentially giving up their own voice in the demands they make and tactics they use.
Mareika Tadil-Betkun, Director of Litigation at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE. Look them up online. They're fantastic. And head along to the Fight for Free Speech, What It Means for Universities, hosted by APN Educational Media. Mareika, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Mareika.
Okay, we now welcome on to the show. This is exciting. The IPA's development associate, Gin Francis. Welcome to the show. Do you like Gin Francis or Gin Campbell?
Francis.
Because you throw me off. Your names are different.
What's going on?
I just realized halfway through, I'm like, is it Gin Francis or Gin Campbell?
It's Gin Campbell. Francis is my middle name. Put on my Facebook.
Just yeah, that's what threw me off, the Facebook.
Nice to meet you, Gin. I'm Peter. How you going?
Hi, Peter. Nice to meet you.
So we've been trying to get Gin for ages, and she's very difficult to get a hold of. So it's very exciting to finally have her on the show.
Yeah, because the IPA hosts a lot of events. So Gin's always tied up with one event or another.
That's right.
And that's why we have you on the show, because the IPA has some absolutely cracking events coming up. And we wanted to talk to someone behind the scenes setting it up as to what our members or attendees at the events can expect on the show. So big few weeks. I think we'll start with something next week, which Peter and I are definitely looking forward to. One of our favourites, the great Dan Hannan, going to be in Perth on the 30th and in Melbourne on the 31st. So do you want to talk about some of the things that are going on with these events?
Yeah, so really excited to have Dan back. I've actually never seen Dan before, so really excited to see him. And I know our members absolutely love him. They're still raving about the last time he was here, which I think was 2015 or something. And so he is going to be in Perth on the 30th and then Melbourne on the 31st. And in Melbourne, he's going to be in conversation with John Roskam and Nick Hayter talking about Brexit, democracy and the future of freedom.
Just a few big topics there for the guys to get stuck into.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where can people buy tickets, Gin?
So you will have received your brilliant "Hey, what did I miss?" email last week and this week as well. So those links will be in there, or else you can call Nina or Francisca at the IPA office on 03-9600-4744.
And all of our listeners know how much of a joy it is to talk to Nina, so make sure you're calling up. We'll talk about that for a second, because Dan Hannan, if you guys don't know, he was one of the big philosophical arguers for Brexit. So
yeah, that's right.
It is so cool that we've got Dan, like one of the architects, one of the biggest voices, member of the European Parliament, always in the European Parliament pushing for Britain to get out, which was pretty cool. Mm. Didn't make a whole lot of friends. So really cool that we've got Dan coming to Melbourne to talk about something that he knows so much about and something that I know a lot of our members really care about. Like, we get a lot of stuff from people that think about Brexit very deeply and what it means.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to be really good as well, because he has quite a good personal relationship with both Nick and John. So I think they're going to be able to bounce off each other really well.
So what are Dan's people like? I know that the punters out there might think you just roll up to an event and it all just happens. But as we know, it takes incredible amounts of organisation. What are Dan's people like? Do they drive a hard bargain or not too bad?
They're actually really lovely. We have had a few that have been quite difficult in the past, but he is absolutely...
I think we all know.
He's really nice. So, yeah, no, we're really looking forward to it.
Fantastic.
Okay, cool. And the other event, this is a big one. So this one got announced this week, I want to say. Letters started hitting people's mailboxes, maybe last week. Last week, people letters started to come out. Now, the IPA, oldest free market think tank in the world.
In the galaxy.
In the galaxy. Check that. Don't check that. You don't need to. We told you the truth. Yeah. So we're celebrating our 75th anniversary this year, and we're going to be doing a big dinner in Melbourne to celebrate on what date?
It's on the 29th of November.
No, I can't make it. No, I'm kidding. I'll be there.
Yeah, we're really excited about that one. So we have we have Janet Albrechtson, Andrew Bolt, and also Brendan O'Neill is coming back for that. So
all friends of the Young IPA podcast. Yeah, exactly. So if you do any of those names jumped out, make sure you're going back through our archive.
Yeah, and then we also have music by Chloe Maggs. I'm not sure if you guys know Chloe Maggs.
Definitely not friend of the podcast.
Not familiar with Chloe's work, no.
No.
Yeah, she's a big deal, so that should be good.
What kind of music is that?
Kind of poppy, fun. It'll be fun.
I've got a question for you, Jin. So this event's on a Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
Will you be giving people excuses they can use to call in sick the next day?
Maybe starting at 11 would fly.
Okay.
I need you in for that podcast the next day.
All right,
we don't miss a day. This podcast does not miss a Friday.
We can record it Thursday. Anyway.
Do a pre-record.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Just hope nothing important happens that night.
So another thing I noticed about that event was... one of the things that it's going to be on was one of the, you know, it's going to have speeches and drinks and all that stuff and dancing.
Yes, key. So we kind of wanted to, we definitely wanted dancing. We have had dancing at one of our events before and we didn't think it would go off.
But did it go off?
Went off to Papa. And so we just wanted to kind of pre-warn people, make sure they've got their dancing shoes on and they're ready to go.
Make sure all pre's are had so they can turn up, they're already ready to go.
We are a responsible serving alcohol organization.
Absolutely. Hey, once you're here, there's responsible serving. Pre's, who knows?
Yeah.
Who is to say? Who is to say? So, Jin, you've been on our event staff and development staff for a while now. You've been working at a lot of our events, a lot of like ones that IPA members have absolutely enjoyed and loved. So what are some of your favourite stories from some of the events that you've been working on?
I have a few, but probably the craziest thing that's ever happened, I was quite new at this point and I went along to the capitalism versus socialism debate at Melbourne Uni. And it was a Generation Liberty event, so a lot of young people. And we had Simon Breeny and John Hadjick were speaking in favour of capitalism, obviously. And a kind of activist group rocked up halfway through and with these big signs and masks and things, and they just screamed the entire time. They did not stop, honestly. The energy was quite amazing. But that was probably the craziest thing. And for me, at the beginning of my IPA career.
Does this happen every Thursday?
Very eye-opening.
That's a good one. Yeah, because I think I remember that video is available on the IPA's YouTube channel if you haven't seen it. So yeah, like you say, Simon and John versus Socialist Alternative. And like this might be a rumor because, you know, stories like develop on their own. But like,
let's just say
someone,
it's true.
Yeah, was someone actually like meowing halfway through Simon's speech?
Yeah.
So that is true. That was actually happening.
There are a lot of really weird noises and I didn't quite understand what was going on.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, anything to disrupt. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They did the job.
Yeah, Simon and John didn't miss a beat.
No, they kept speaking and I was standing there thinking, I want to go down and tell them to be quiet. But obviously, you know, you can't. And the guys kept speaking and, yeah, didn't miss a word. It was amazing.
Mm.
What about a favourite guest? Is there one particular guest that you were like, I really like this person?
Yeah, so Brendan O'Neill, actually. I loved Brendan O'Neill. He was on tour with him around the country and he was just the easiest most relaxed guy to deal with. He was so nice. And this was when I was kind of starting to, mold my political beliefs. And he was just a very accessible guy.
What a way to mold your political beliefs. Yeah. Travel around the country with Brendan O'Neill.
Yeah.
Very lucky.
That's not
There's
what
happened
to me.
There's an indie film in that. Yeah, because we've had a fair few international people on the show, and you know it can be hard to sort of match up timetables to make sure us three are here to make a call, and then you know they need to be at a desk.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but in other countries it's a different time to what it is now here.
I didn't know that until we started doing the show. Yeah. So that blew me away. But Brendan O'Neill, I think one of the very few people that have offered to adjust their schedule. Like he was like, "I'll come into work early to make this podcast."
Yeah,
which I was like. You're Brendan O'Neill. Yeah, why do you need to do that? So yeah, absolute legend of a bloke.
Yeah, he had the flu at the end of that too, and he.
I remember
was
that he was very sick. Yeah,
actually really sick, and he was such a trooper. Yeah, he's really lovely.
Mm. All right, so we'll move on. So the one thing, so you do like Brendan O'Neill, but one thing I know that you two disagree on is dogs, because Brendan O'Neill not a big fan of dogs, but Jin.
I did not know that.
Fun fact. Jin, you have a brand new puppy in your life.
Yeah.
Talk us through it.
He is I think he's 14 weeks now. I need to stop talking in weeks and sound like one of those crazy mums.
Yeah, my baby's 87 weeks old. No, it isn't. It's a year and a half.
And he's a Hungarian Vizsla. He is like a gun dog, I guess, in that sort of family.
What do you mean? What's a gun dog?
A hunting.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Right. So same as, Weimaraner and... I don't know, German pointer and things like that. But he is very cute and very difficult at times.
Yeah, because let's talk damage. Like, what has this dog destroyed so far? Because it's a very active dog.
Yeah.
Spirit.
Yeah. Oh, no. Chin's spirit. So, look at this interview.
So he's too small and weak at the moment to be super destructive.
Right.
But he has taken books off the bookshelf and destroyed a couple of those. And we have had to move all of our floor plants up to higher places. Everything's just on a higher place now.
Is your dog a member of Antifa? Just a lot of book destroying going on?
That's good.
Sorry, look into it. Just go through the YouTube search history when you come home, see what kind of videos he's watching.
I would like to make one criticism of dogs, and I want to see how you feel about this.
Oh, you are walking on thin ice, my friend.
See, I don't know. Nina's
also.
Everyone gets excited about dogs, right?
Yes.
But they're not as smart as humans. How do you deal with that criticism?
Who said they were?
I never said they were. They are unbelievably smart. So we got Irvin, his name is, this little puzzle toy, and it would take me a while to figure out. And he figured it out in the first go. I came back after about an hour and he'd been playing with it and all the little bits of food were out of all the little sections in this toy and I was just shocked.
Your return comment, Pete.
Be that as it may, maybe this is a special case. Maybe this dog's smarter than the dog. But, people are like, oh my God, my dog's so smart. It knows when I'm saying let's go for a walk. It's like, so does every human pretty much. Anyway, that's it. Like, maybe I'm just a dog
Scrooge
or something.
I've got one dog who really loves food. So one of my dog really likes snacks, and we used to put all of his little treats in this ball, so at least he'd have some physical exercise because he had to play with the ball to knock it around to get a treat out of it.
Yeah.
And he would continue to play with it 3 hours after the last treat came out of it, just in case.
See?
Just in case.
That's amazing,
if it was a human, it would know that was stupid.
Mm.
Sorry.
I like the endeavour. I like the work ethic.
Yeah, fair enough.
If you started showing some of the work ethic.
Of a dog. Yeah.
All right,
well,
cool.
That's all I got.
That's all we got. Jin, thank you so much. Oh, sorry. Go to Hey What Did I Miss, the IPA's weekly email newsletter. If you remember, you would be getting that automatically. If not, make sure you're signing up online. So that's all the details you need for the Dan Hannan tour. Mm-hmm. So let's go through the dates again. So 30th of October, that's in Perth.
That's in Perth.
And 31st of October, that's in Melbourne.
Yep.
And then the IPA's 75th anniversary dinner, dancing. Mandatory, I'm going to say. If you do not dance, we will throw you out of the building. Is that all right?
Yeah.
I think fair to say. What date again?
The 29th of November, and you can go to ipa.org.au/events for that one.
Yeah, and there's also a banner on our homepage, so you can't miss it.
I just couldn't reiterate enough. Our events are awesome, right? And they take a lot of work from Jin and the team. So good on ya.
So
get
good.
To an event. Have a great time.
Absolutely. That's hopefully awesome. See you guys on the 29th.
Thank you.
I got to write the fourth time. Okay, thank you to Marika and Jin for those interviews. Really interesting chat. So, we did this last week. Mm. It went really well. I really enjoyed it. So, before we get into the funny ones, we've got Here's a Cool Thing,
yeah.
which is Pete, or me, but yeah. this week Pete, and last week Pete, just taking a look around the world and just seeing a really cool story that, you know, isn't going to get a whole lot of mainstream attention, but it should.
And it isn't bad. And it's a positive story.
It's very positive.
We might not be able to find one every week because it's hard for us to find cool things. A lot.
Yeah, but it's a very bleak world out there.
This is one thing. So it's a study from a guy from the United Kingdom. Now, there's the guy called James Tooley, who's a researcher. And I wrote about this a long time ago. It was in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday. It's about low-cost private schools in developing countries. This guy found that even though in a lot of developing countries there are government schools that are free, even the poorest people in these countries choose to send their kids to private school, even though they don't have much money, they still think it's a worthwhile investment. So we're talking, you know, $2, $3, $4 American dollars a month for these schools that are kind of located at the end of their street. You know, they're not, you know, very well equipped schools or anything like that, but they outperform government schools in all the key areas. So that's what he kind of discovered was going on in the developing world. And it actually kind of brought into question all these figures we have about how many kids are going to school and stuff like that. You know, there was 130 million kids not going to school, but he's saying actually a lot of them probably go to these private schools that are unregistered. Anyway, what happened was during the week, a study came out about some funding from the British aid organisation, whose name is escaping me at present, Department for International Development, who thought, well, this is good, let's get in on this, right? Let's get some government money involved in this, and gave some money to an organisation in the United States to do some of these private schools. Now, what the study found out was that actually the private schools that are already in these countries like India, Nigeria, Ghana, stuff like that, were actually performing just as well as the private schools funded, or the schools funded by the aid organisation through this fancy organisation for the United States. So once again, it reinforces this idea that the market is solving a lot of these problems really well. And of course, both of those schools outperformed the government schools.
Yeah, and
does that all make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's sort of like a microcosm of something that there's a whole lot of evidence for, and I know you've been working a lot in this field, which is...
A little bit.
Yeah, but like the idea that foreign aid can be extremely ineffective, and the idea that if you just donate to the governments and it'll trickle down to the, you know, people that need it, isn't effective.
Yeah. So this is not them giving money to the government. It's giving money to an organisation in the United States to do this.
Oh, no,
stuff.
But I'm talking like people would say, oh, we need to invest in schooling in developing countries, so therefore give the education department all this money, and then these schools aren't actually working. What is working are the low-cost private schools.
That's right. I mean, a lot of these government schools are supported by foreign aid. So and the market's doing a lot better. And it's just a great story to hear. You know, it's a really positive story.
Yeah, cool. So the article was put together by our friends at the Institute for Economic Affairs in the UK. So go check out their blog if you want to read that article. Really cool stuff, and they're a really cool organization. So make sure you're doing that. Okay, so we'll move on to some funny stories that made us laugh this week. If I can start, Pete.
You can.
All right, cool. Now, there is a supermarket chain in the UK called Waitrose. They've got a few places all around. Mm. And they...
I think they're a fancy one too.
Oh, fancy.
I'm not sure, but I think so.
Well, based on the rest of the story, I would say fancy. They used to sell a chicken sandwich here. The Gentleman's Smoked Chicken Caesar Roll.
Okay.
Now, there was a single complaint online. Now, again, we want to talk about the 500,000 people allegedly at the Brexit march and the 160,000... Go online, because if you can get a single complaint happening, these places will crumble.
Mm.
In the street, you know, everyone's looking at their screens anyway. They can't see what's happening in the street. They can't see what's happening on their phones.
That's right.
Amy Lane, appointed late London Mayor Sadiq Khan, he's back as the capital, like as London's first Knights are in 2016, just to give you an idea of what she's about, posted an image online of the Gentleman Smoked Chicken Caesar Roll and said, I never knew that sandwiches were gender specific.
Mm, which is an interesting tweet.
Interesting tweet. Waitrose buckled immediately. They've taken that sandwich off the shelves, or at least have renamed it. So, and they said, it's never our intention to cause offense. We're not dictating who should eat this sandwich. A lot to unpack with this story.
There is a little bit to unpack. I just want to know, does Amy think the sandwich has a penis? Because...
I was just thinking, like, they say, we're not dictating who should eat this sandwich. And then Amy says, I never knew sandwiches were gender specific.
Yeah. Does she think the sandwich is a man?
Yep.
Well,
like based on that. But I want to find the person that sees Gentleman's Chicken Roll.
Yeah.
Just the person that says, that's not for me.
Yeah.
I really wanted that chicken roll.
Yeah.
I really wanted it, but gentlemen.
It sounds absolutely disgusting, this sandwich, by the way. But I think they've just sat around and thought, look, women aren't going to eat this crap. Let's market it at stupid men who eat rubbish. But
no, so what it is, so it contains anchovy mayonnaise, which brings me back to Pete's initial thoughts that it sounds terrible. Similar to Gentleman's Relish anchovy paste. So that's why they're trying to get in on people thinking it's that relish, I think.
Well, yeah. Anyway. So that's...
By the way, so when you said before how Waitrose is like a fairly upmarket supermarket chain,
yeah,
that should have dawned on me earlier because we're talking about an anchovy mayonnaise, smoked chicken Caesar roll.
Yeah, well, that screams affluence.
Yeah, you need to have a public sector job if you're going to enjoy that kind of roll.
But a bit of background on this woman, right? So she is a night czar for Sadiq Khan.
Yeah.
So this is the woman in charge of London's nightlife to ensuring that London's nightlife remains really good. I didn't think nightlife in London had a problem, but that's... So that's her job. Yeah. And she's complaining about the name of the sandwich. So I don't know if she's the correct woman for the job. And also, what's the deal with Tsar? Like, I thought Tsar was kind of a nickname for government positions. But that's her official title.
Yeah, I guess so.
Look into that.
Look, I'm assuming Amy's left wing. Does she really want to be called a Tsar? I don't know. Left wings and Tsars have had some run-ins in the past.
That's a good point. And look, she's also under fire. I actually did quite a bit of research for this story. But she's actually under fire because she's in charge of the nightlife, right?
Yeah.
And she's sort of overseeing this situation where all these bars and pubs in London are having to close early.
Oh, right.
I didn't do heaps of research. So that's all I've got. But yeah.
That's more than I could ask
for. So it doesn't surprise me. Anyway.
I'm also worried because my favourite drink is an old fashioned.
Yes.
And she doesn't sound like she enjoys old fashioned things. So London takes away my old fashions, count me out.
Well, anyway.
Anyway. All right, cool. We'll move on to another one. So, it's your turn, Pete.
Okay.
Fire away.
Look, something I've noticed this week is that it's actually been a really tough week for the UK. A lot of these stories are UK based.
It's been a tough couple of years, let's be honest. It's just not the great place of freedom and free speech anymore.
No. A lot of these stories are negative and they're from the UK.
Yeah.
I've
got a UK story later, actually.
Yeah, look, it's an
absolute fiend.
It's been a really tough week. The police in Kent, which is the region of the UK, for those that don't know, are spending public money on posters to encourage shopkeepers to not sell eggs and flowers to kids under the age of 16. Because it's coming up to Halloween and allegedly they'll chuck them around. Now, the posters say throwing flour and eggs is not funny and you could end up in trouble. Spoiler alert, throwing flour and eggs is funny.
I don't think so.
So, well, what do you mean?
I don't think it's funny. I just don't think people getting hit with eggs is funny. I'm not with the Kent police, but the idea that it's not funny, I'm like, well, you know.
I couldn't disagree more, James. You know, go and eat the gentleman's sandwich.
I shall. All right, I'll eat that anchovy paste.
Anyway, this is back to the not crime thing. So the government, the police have enough. They're not saying it's a crime. They're just encouraging shopkeepers to stop kids doing something that's not a crime.
Well, they did say
rather than stopping actual crime.
They did say selling these items during the Halloween period is closely monitored. Which I was like, I want them to unpack what that means. Yeah. Like, are we going through people's bags, or is it going to be like, you know how teenagers will loiter outside like a bottle and say, hey, can you buy us this? Here's some money. It's like, hey, can you buy us some eggs and flour?
Yeah.
We've got to go make a cake. Yeah. I like this. They also said
making cakes.
Yeah, yeah. So Kent police also issued some other advice for parents who are letting their children out to trick or treat. Never let young children go trick or treating on their own. Fair enough. Make sure they only visit people known to your family. That's a little weird.
What? So my cousins that live in Bendigo.
Yeah. It's a long drive to get three whiz fizzes.
Yeah, no, let them speak to the weirdos in your neighbourhood.
Yeah. If you have teenagers, make sure they're not going to be using alcohol, flour, or eggs. How many teenagers trick-or-treat?
Yeah, mate.
Like, you grow out of that around 11, surely.
Yeah. It's like wearing a footy jumper to the footy.
And then they go, last one here is my favourite. Make sure they understand not to frighten people.
Yeah.
Which costume? Which 6-year-old has a costume available to frighten someone?
Well, I thought the whole thing was that meant to frighten people.
No, but like a 6-year-old as a spooky ghost,
but it's a Halloween,
is not spooky.
It's a Halloween, isn't it? That's the whole thing.
You want to dress as something a bit weird.
Yeah, you got an axe in your head.
I don't think that's actually a witch at my door.
Yeah, well, but some people
that is my theory.
Some people might think so. Anyway.
Oh, sorry. I shot a guy in the head because I thought that being egged wasn't funny. Yeah. But you think, people actually do get frightened on Halloween, so we do need to take it a bit seriously.
I was being sarcastic.
Oh, okay. But I didn't pick it up because, you know, you say everything so sarcastically. It just sounds null. Anyway, cool. I got another one, also from the UK. So Jamila Jamil, she's an actress. You might know her from The Good Place, which is a really good TV show this season. Not so much. Usually it's very good.
Not familiar.
But she's very good in it. And she put out a tweet. What a powerhouse. Rihanna's grown into such an important voice for women, for people of color, and for body positivity. Turning down a $2 million check and all the publicity and the records and clothes and makeup she would have sold off the back of it is God-level boss. So basically, Rihanna said, I'm not doing the Super Bowl halftime show because Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job.
Oh, okay.
And so she's saying, oh, what a powerful thing. Now, can you spot the issue with that tweet?
Well, she said God-level boss instead of goddess-level boss, which is obviously sexist.
God is a woman.
Well,
Nina, can you spot the problem with the tweet?
Nah.
Okay, here's the problem with the tweet. Jamil quote tweeted herself and then said, I made a mistake by saying people of color here. I've been educated to make sure it is clear I specifically say black people, as to broaden it to people of color dilutes their cause and struggle. I'm very sorry for that error. We'll be more careful in future.
Well, I'm glad she cleared that up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, you go. Oh, no, well, obviously it's always funny when lefties get in trouble for their own garbage.
Yep.
And the second one is, I like it how she says, I've been educated, as if like copying abuse from a few oxygen thieves on Twitter is like, oh, now I have wisdom.
I this person, now, yes.
You know,
peer-reviewed material has been brought to my attention.
Now I get it.
Yeah. I also go, my thing is, like, we've joked on the podcast how easy it is to be a lefty journalist.
We have.
Yeah. You just say the emotional thing.
Yeah, bad
the
thing.
Knee-jerk emotional.
Bad thing, cursed society.
Yeah. I now think it's... That to me proves that being left wing is the most difficult thing in the world right
well,
now.
Well, maybe we were wrong. Maybe
like,
we
if you can't praise Rihanna for being a voice for people of color, if that's bad now,
yeah,
boy oh boy, you've got to like re-educate yourself every day as to what's acceptable and not acceptable.
You need constant re-education.
Constant re-education.
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe we're a bit harsh on lefties. It is a tough gig. We apologize to like, all the lefties out there. How difficult it is.
That's some high standards for leftism.
Yeah. Yep. No, look, I'm with you.
Yeah. That's... I really feel sorry for Jamila Jamil there.
So do I.
All right. Check out Good Place, though. It's a very good show. Cool. We want to talk France?
Yeah, let's talk about France. Let's talk about France. What did you say?
Cross the pond. No, that's America. Go down the channel.
Yeah. Very good.
I've got an American one later, though, so we'll cross the pond then.
Yeah. Stay tuned for that.
Live producing for you.
A French member of parliament has proposed that mockery of accents be outlawed. Mockery of accents be outlawed after an irate politician derided a journalist southwestern of France pronunciation. So this politician in France got asked a tough question and they made fun of the person's accent.
Yeah,
and then
they said, does anyone have a question in understandable French? Which is a pretty good burn.
Which is a good burn.
That's a good burn.
So in response to that, Letitia Avia and I apologise if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, of President Emmanuel Macron's ruling party said she was proposing a bill that would classify such mockery with other forms of prohibited discrimination such as race and gender and all that stuff.
My thing with this is France outlawing the ability of someone to make fun of other countries is not going to go down well with the French population.
Yeah.
There is nothing they love more than making fun of other countries.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Like Canada.
Like more. No, they're fans of Canada, Dana.
Canada specifically.
Where did Canada come from? Well, I heard that.
I was going US. They love making fun of Americans.
Yeah. What made you say
and
that?
British people.
Yeah,
it's like, couldn't... oh, you guys can't, do a stupid southern accent while imitating a US tourist anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, expressing their superiority is the national game.
That's all they have left.
That's all
they have. We've taken everything else. They only have that left.
Look, a bit rough. And this woman tweeted out, do you speak poorer French if you have an accent? Do people have to endure humiliation if the pronunciation is not of the standardized kind? So she's speaking truth to power.
Mm, in a good accent. In a weird accent.
Yep.
Yep. So I've got one final one here. So Bruce Reeves Bartlett. He's an American historian.
Bruce.
Brucey boy.
He sounds like an Adelaide plumber.
Yeah. but he's not. He's a domestic policy advisor to Ronald Reagan and a treasury official under George H.W. Bush.
Okay.
So pretty big fish. But he had a bad tweet.
Oh.
He had a bad, bad tweet.
Yeah.
He's cooked it. He not a fan of Trump. Not at all. His Twitter feed, he does not like Trump one iota. And I'll try and preface this because it's going to come out very weirdly. But anyway, so what I think he was trying to do was try to say that Trump is worse than Hitler.
Okay.
Here's how it came out. Key differences between Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler. Hitler served honorably in the military, Trump didn't. Hitler was faithful to his wife, Trump cheated on all his wives. Hitler wrote a book, Trump's are all ghost written. It's a bit of a swing and a miss.
You want to say something, it just doesn't come out quite
just,
right.
Yeah, it just misses the mark by that much.
Hitler's a really good bloke. He wrote a book, he was in the army.
On a second thought.
Can I object to one of them? Hitler was faithful to his wife. They were married one day before he killed himself.
Yeah, but he was faithful.
Like, yeah, he was faithful. He did not cheat on anyone. He did not cheat on her with anyone else in that bunker deep underneath Berlin. Where it was just the two of them.
If he did, he'd work quickly. But if they... Is he... Like, has there been some kind of hand-wringing, you know, like...
No, I think he's stood by it. I think he's just like, oh, look, if you want to misinterpret that tweet to say it's praising of Hitler, then go ahead. Well, but it's clearly not my intention. But
that's positive. Look, at least he's done that.
Yeah, he's not giving in. But I'm like, dude, that is... That's a swing and a miss. It's a bad, bad tweet.
Didn't drink. It's pretty healthy.
Look, he didn't... He was against animal cruelty.
Yeah. We've all said things that just haven't come out quite right.
I don't think I've ever said anything as badly as that, though. Yep. And as public as on Twitter.
Come on, Bruce.
Brucey boy, you swung and you missed there. All right, cool. That's it for the show this week. Thanks again to Marika and Jin for those interviews. Really interesting chat. So make sure you're checking out the Fire Network in the US if you want to learn more about campus censorship. And make sure you're coming along to the IPA's events in Perth and Melbourne coming up. Once again, Dan Hannon, 30 October. In Perth, 31st of October, Halloween themed. I'm still pushing for that. In Melbourne. And then the 29th of November, not Halloween themed, the IPA 75th anniversary dinner. Do not go in Halloween costume to that. At all.
It's black
Do
tie.
Not spook people.
Unless your costume is black tie.
Unless your costume is black tie. Do not bring eggs and flour as well.
No.
Unless you bring a cupcake.
Unless you bring a cupcake. No, I don't think we want people bringing cupcakes. You can bring a cupcake to Nina, who's going to be working the front desk, but you can't go into the auditorium.
Alex, have a cupcake.
That's up there with the Canada comment for being completely random.
Yeah, that's completely random.
But at least there was some factual...
it just popped up in my mind.
But at least there was some logical conclusion that eggs and flour ended in cupcake. Whereas there was no logical conclusion. And the French people hated Canadians.
Yeah.
Don't know where that came from.
I don't know either. It's like just popped. Sorry, right. Canadian.
Let's end this damn thing. All right. So thanks so much for listening and subscribing. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. Make sure you're leaving us a rating on iTunes. That 5-star review helps us out with the rankings. And also go ahead and subscribe to the Great Books of Literature podcast. Once again, Heart of Darkness is this fortnight's episode. And Nina, if people have heard this podcast, they've heard you talk about French-Canadian relations and they want to support the IPA and what we stand for, where can they go to become members and donate?
Oh, just visit the website, ipa.org.au. You can find donate button if you want to donate and join button if you like to become a member.
Very cool. See you guys next week.
Stay up.